Mark Maron. It's 6 past the hour here on Air America Radio, and this is Morning Sedition. That's right. Good morning, geniuses, philosopher kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives. I want to say a special good morning to my mother-in-law, Diane, out there in Seattle, whose birthday I missed because of her daughter. I would have said happy birthday yesterday, could not say it because I was not informed. I'm going to write it down on my Palm Pilot software. Happy birthday, Diane. Have a nice day driving the people around. Good morning to you, Mark Riley.
Good morning, Mark Maron.
How's it going, buddy? All right?
Yeah, I'm all right.
I almost died yesterday, I think.
Why?
I went out with my buddy, Jonathan. I don't eat all day. You know, I do. I eat before I come here, and then I don't eat all day, and we went to this Asian place, Republic, where I had a bowl of, you know, that broth, the coconut broth, the Thai coconut broth?
Yeah.
I had a huge bowl of that with salmon in it, and I don't know what it was. Maybe it was too rich. I've been eating too plain, but I ate the whole thing and literally felt like I'd OD'd on drugs. I was sweating. I was bloated. I almost went down.
Which would have been
embarrassing.
Do you have cayenne pepper in there or something?
It wasn't a pepper thing. I don't know what it was, but it was the coconut. It was too rich, and it literally, how embarrassing would that be to have OD'd on coconut broth? You know, where's the glory in that? You know, I'm talking from the point of view of an old, drug warrior myself. You don't want to be OD'ing on coconut broth.
Well, Maron, I'm sure that restaurant is thrilled that you said their name.
In that context, yeah. Go to Republic and get the sweats.
Where is it exactly?
It's down in Union Square. It's a good place. I haven't eaten there. The theme of the restaurant is sort of Asian, but they do it like they're a little kind of, they kind of hot rod all the noodle dishes and noodle soups. I don't think it was the soup's fault. Don't think there was anything wrong with the soup. I think it was my problem. If you're going to start in with the coconut broth, you got to go easy. You got to chip away at it first. Maybe one day you have a little taste. And then the next day, maybe a cup. I went right for the full bowl because that's the way I am. And you know, that's the weird thing about restaurants, if I could ramble on a little more before we get to anything important, is that, you know, you don't have to eat the amount they give you. Did you know that? I don't know if you guys know that. That it's not a rule or an unspoken law. When you go to a place, I mean, the bowl of soup that I ate yesterday theoretically could have fed 5 people. It was that big. And I'd had
So you could have taken it home.
I could have done that, Riley, but no, I saw it as a personal challenge. They were defying me to eat that bowl of soup, my friend.
And eat it you did.
I certainly did.
Who's they?
What do you mean they?
The chef.
Yeah, the people at the Republic, the restaurant. Because then there's the problem is, if I don't eat this, where's it going to go? In the garbage? What happens to all that fish? Like when I go to Marino's and Sons and they give me some scallops over there in Astoria, and I always wonder about that. If I don't take these scallops, what's going to happen to them in 3 days?
Three days?
Yeah.
They're not staying out for 3 days.
All right, 2 days, whatever. However long it takes, where's all that food going, Riley? I don't know where the food's going.
Somebody frying it up.
I know when I go to the green market and they cut the tops of the heads off, they take that stuff back in a bag, back to the farm, put it in the ground, and reuse it as compost.
I understand that.
That, to me, makes sense.
That makes perfect sense. We used to do composting at one time. I don't know if we use fish heads or anything. But composting makes perfect sense because you take the waste and you help something else grow with it.
I'm going to start that today. I'm going to start composting today in Queens. I'm going to start a compost business with my throwaways.
Really?
Yeah, that's what I learned this morning. Thanks for helping me out with the business idea. You want in? You can be my partner.
Well, I don't know, man.
Come on, Maron and Riley.
As much money as you're making for Apple, I don't know if it makes any sense.
Dude, what about that? I buy one iPod for $1.2 billion and stocks go up.
Yeah. Apple stock skyrocketed on the sales of iPods. Thanks, Mark.
I got the best one. I thought I got the bad one, but I guess paying that kind of money for the iPod was the right thing to do. Chief Justice Rehnquist in the hospital. I don't think he did it on purpose. I think he has cancer. But the sad thing is somewhere in the White House, when he went into the hospital, someone went, yes! Because as soon as they can get into this, the quicker they get in this, the quicker they can take the focus off of the traitor Rove, who is George Bush's symbiotic twin, as we will talk about later in just a few minutes. If the Chief Justice, if that thing gets underway, if he picks a nominee, that takes this whole Rove-gate, treasonous behavior of the President's Deputy Chief of Staff, off of the media hot plate. But we're not going to let it happen today, Riley.
No, we're not, because Karl Rove is more than just the president's right-hand man. He's more than just the architect of his successful campaign last year.
Yeah.
And we're going to talk a little bit about what the stakes are for some members of Congress if Karl Rove goes down.
Right on. Bernie Ebers took the big hit, man. Big hit. I mean, it was like after Monday when that one judge says that she would sign off on, you know, a little, you know, $5 million fine and take his property. He's going down hard in a U.S. District Courthouse right here in Manhattan after citing that his heart condition wasn't bad enough to warrant a lesser sentence. Judge Barbara Jones handed down a 25-year prison sentence to ex-WorldCom CEO Bernie Ebers for bilking the public and shareholders out of $11 billion.
Yeah, and of course, Bernie Ebers is 63 years old now. So that means if he does the full 25, he won't be out till he's 87.
Yep.
And, you know, this is a guy who used to kind of swagger across America's corporate landscape. He was one of those big success stories from the 1990s. But if you listen to some of the people that ended up with the short end of the stick from WorldCom, one of them told the court that the telecom company's collapse caused, quote, untold human carnage.
This was a guy that used to work there.
Yeah. Former salesman.
WorldCom was certainly the largest of the recent corporate frauds and actually the biggest bankruptcy in history. Ebers wept audibly in the courtroom after sentencing.
Do we have any sound of that?
No, wait.
I wish. There we go. Where's Mort Milfington when we need him? That's it. There you go. Bye, Bernie.
I almost feel bad for that. Guys going to the big house. All right, Chief, the head of Homeland Security, the new secretary of the Homeland Security Agency, Michael Chertoff, has got some big ideas.
Yeah.
He's got some big ideas. Apparently, he ordered a review of the agency last March, 2 months after he took office there. The results of the review and the new proposal of what he's going to do with the agency were presented to lawmakers, department employees, and other officials yesterday. As you know, Homeland Security was designed to be the government's chief center for analyzing terror threats. It's an interagency office. What am I saying? Please, Mark, read what you wrote down. Homeland Security merged 22 agencies, the largest government reorganization in 50 years. As I said, it was designed to be, the agency that monitors all terror threats. But in the past, when it was under Tom Ridge, it has taken some heat for being sort of a pork central, for dispersing and allowing money to be funneled through there into contracts that were completely unnecessary and sort of opened the door to the big security business. I mean, you know, if you think about it, where some of that money is gone, it's pretty profound, because there's been accusations, like they're not even accusations. In 2003, Tulsa, Oklahoma received $725,000 in port security funds, Riley.
Port, as in there's water somewhere near
Port
Tulsa?
Oklahoma. More than $4 million in 2005 federal anti-terror funding will go to the Northern Mariana Islands. Of course.
Yes, that is, of course, where Tom DeLay went back in the day to assure people that the sweatshops and the sex shops could continue to operate.
In 2003, Grand Forks County, North Dakota received $1.5 million in federal funds to purchase trailers equipped to respond to nuclear attacks. So Chertoff, Michael Chertoff, the Homeland Security Department secretary, newly appointed, has got some big ideas. He says he says he's going to trim the pork out of the agency. He's going to be retooling terror watch lists and use to screen airline passengers to eliminate the high number of false positives.
Yeah.
He's going to improve the immigration system as part of bolstering border security. The department will deploy more personnel and technology at the borders to deter illegal immigrants, and a newly approved temporary worker program should help immigrants seeking jobs in the U.S. into regulated legal channels. So he's got some ideas that will make Lou Dobbs happy.
Well, yeah, and I guess that means that the $500,000 grant for security to protect Brooklyn's corn crop must be off the table. What Michael Chertoff is doing here, Mark, mm-hmm. is trying to shake up this corporate culture at Homeland Security, which had turned into, because, you know, you had these, 22 agencies that comprised Homeland Security. Well, those were 22 different warring fiefdoms, and there were a series of constant turf battles, and that's how a lot of this money ended up, you know, falling through the cracks. That's why you end up having situations where places where the nearest port is 1,000 miles away is getting $750,000 for port security. Yeah, that's how it happened.
And let's not forget the fact that Tom Ridge was, you know, George Bush's buddy. And, you know, this was a guy that was a Republican, you know, party operative. He was a governor of Pennsylvania,
yes,
right?
Yes, he was.
And he sent him in there. And this guy was kind of a doofus, but he just allowed people to exploit, you know, these contracts, these security contracts. Many of the technologies were half-baked that, you know, went through. That made fortunes for people in the security contracting business. So Chertoff's going to, you know, sort of oversee those contracts better, so he says, and most importantly announced the creation of an intelligence director to centralize the analysis of information gathered by the 11 Homeland Security bureaus. The director, when appointed, will be asked to improve Homeland Security standing with the intelligence community, where it is sort of looked down upon a bit, sort of like, oh, Homeland Security, what are you guys up to?
Yeah, well, look, you know, here's hoping he can do it, but let's see if he can pull it off. Corporate culture, in many instances, very tough to change.
Yeah, but I mean, it's only been there for, it's not that deeply entrenched, is it? How can it be so deeply
entrenched?
All of
these 22 different agencies have brought their own corporate culture to the table.
That's right. Well, speaking about corporate culture, let's segue into the fact that I think Karl Rove's going down. The president was distancing himself from his own best friend, from his symbiotic twin, from his brain, from the man that he acts as penis for, Karl Rove. We'll get into that next. It's 17 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark. Good morning.
Morning Sedition, delivering you from evil in 3 hours or less. Air America Radio.
Hey, it's 21 past the hour. Good morning. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark on Air America Radio. Let's do this, man. Karl Rove. Who is Karl Rove? Who is he? He's been in the Republican administration in one way or the other for years. He was the National Executive Director of College Republicans from 1971 to 1972. All right, now, so dig this. He leaves school to campaign for chair of the College Republicans with help from Lee Atwater, some of you remember, who ran...
The late Lee Atwater.
Yes.
Mr. Willie Horton from 1988.
One of the evil demons that on his deathbed, because, you know, he died, his conscience killed him. His conscience turned into a tumor and ate him from the inside, and he later felt bad about it. Karl Rove was in a heated campaign that split the college Republicans into warring factions at the national convention. Both Rove and his opponent declare victory, and the decision is sent to RNC chairman George H.W. Bush for resolution, who was a congressman at the time,
yes,
right? While Bush is resolving the issue, a Rove opponent leaked a tape to the White Washington Post of a Rove college seminar in which he recounts a tale of dirty tricks. So Rove has been up to dirty tricks since 1973 when he was in the College Republican. Apparently George H.W. Bush, so impressed with the guy, hires him on.
Yeah.
So when does Karl Rove fall in love with George W. Bush? Well, I'll tell you when it was. It was the year was 1973
right after Bush's famed stint in the National Guard.
That's right. So apparently George H.W. Bush asks Rove to take a set of car keys to his son. So he picks him up at the train station. Picks him up at the train station.
Too cheap to fly?
Right, and he sees George W. Bush. This is a young George W. Bush at home from Harvard Business School, walking towards him in his bomber jacket and his cowboy boots. And this is a quote directly from Karl Rove, says, he was exuding more charisma than any one individual should be allowed to have. And that is where the man crush began. Those who know the two say that their interplay is that of an old married couple. There is bickering, rivalry, dependency, joking around. A campaign aide from his 1992 gubernatorial election campaign, this is a Republican woman, says they are like twin brothers and communicate so intimately with each other that much of it is unintelligible to others. What does that mean? Who's a big boy? So that's who they are as a couple. Okay, so when you talk about Rove, you're talking about Bush. They are emotionally intertwined in this like weird, unrecovered codependency dance of death. Bush is Rove's political penis. Rove decides who and what they screw. So that is the way this works. I mean, given that no presidential aide, certainly in modern history, has had as much power as Rove, there is no way to separate George Bush from Karl Rove. So when something is wrong with the other feels it. They're like metaphoric Siamese twins.
You know, Karl Rove has spent the last 30-odd years drop, like Johnny Appleseed, just dropping these little seeds in the ground with the young Republicans and then with George H.W. Bush and then with his son. And now Karl Rove has more power than any other presidential aide in recent history, in modern history. This is a guy who George W. Bush, quite frankly, cannot afford to make a move without. And Karl Rove is central to the reelection chances of an awful lot of people in Congress next year.
That's because he micromanages all of these campaigns down to a precinct level. This dude is on top of everything. He is the go-to guy. He runs Mehlman over there at the RNC.
Yeah, that's his protege.
Yeah, and he micromanages policy. You know, he leads outreach efforts to key GOP constituencies. He's got his hands in everything, which is masterful, but he's evil.
Well, see, that's why it's so ridiculous to think that there's that much distance between the White House and the RNC. You remember this thing the other day where the
talking
White House
point.
Yeah, and they're saying, "Oh, no, that was from the RNC. The White House had nothing to do with it." That is complete and utter nonsense.
Rove is in his office in the West Wing of the White House, sitting there running this thing like a war room. You can bet your life. And as you said on the break, there's even the possibility, like yesterday, George Bush comes out and distance himself.
Yeah.
He surprised a lot of Republicans with the quote that he said that, quote, this is a serious investigation into Rove. He didn't even say it, he just said, this is a serious investigation. I will be more than happy to comment on this matter once the investigation is complete. I will also not prejudge the investigation based on media reports, end quote. That is his metaphoric lover he's talking about, and he shocked Republicans by not just coming out and out and endorsing him with confidence.
I tell you, I don't think he shocked Karl Rove. I think Karl Rove told him to say this. I think Karl Rove told him, keep your distance for now. If I need you, I'll call you.
But there is no doubt that they are intrinsically connected, and that if you don't know who Karl Rove is, he is the guy that designed President Bush's political personality, his political strategy, his policies, both domestic and now even international on some level. He is really the guy who pulls the strings on Bush, for Bush and everything about Bush. So if you are, not knowledgeable about, who Karl Rove is and why is he important, he's a guy that compromised national security by outing a CIA undercover agent. We'll talk about their talking points after this, but he is a traitor, and he is intrinsically and symbiotically connected to the President of the United States, and he is the stink on that administration right now. He is Bush's fault and vice versa. We'll get more into it a little later in the show. Hope you're having a good morning. It's 27 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio. In honor of CNN's 25th anniversary, Morning Sedition is proud to present Great Moments in Journalism on CNN.
He believes, in fact, these prisoners are treated well. He believes a lot of this talk about abuses, that they're actually been overdone, and that this report by Amnesty International suggesting that, in fact, Guantanamo is a gulag is not true. Chairman Hunter also noted that while the Senate, a couple of different Senate committees are thinking about...
Ed Henry, I'm sorry, it's Candy. I'm going to have to cut you off there. We have some breaking news out of California. I am told that we have a verdict in the Michael Jackson case.
This has been Great Moments in Journalism on CNN, brought to you by Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
See that? Reality is funny. It's 35 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. I'm Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley right there.
That wasn't
there.
Made up?
No, that was completely real.
And by the way, they spent 2.5 hours after that announcement doing nothing but showing pictures of people driving around in cars.
Yeah, they love that. Especially if they're people being chased.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, obviously it's hard to figure out what the headlines are saying. Thank God for the iNews Wi-Fi headline translator, the iNews 5000. Let's kick it up and feed it some headlines. If you want to hear that intro live, we'll be broadcasting live this Friday from Restaurant Florent on Gansevoort Street in the Meatpacking District of New York City. Steve Earle is going to be performing a couple songs. Plus, we'll have your buddy, Mr. Ferrer. Fernando Ferrer, a mayoral candidate, is going to try and explain how he's going to win this mayoral race now that the biggest union in the city has gotten behind Michael Bloomberg. We'll be giving away free coffee, tons of other stuff. That's Restaurant Florent on Gansevoort Street in the Meatpacking District. This is Friday from 6 to 9. That is tomorrow morning. So let's feed this machine some headlines. That's what we're doing, isn't it? From the Associated Press, Bush won't comment on Roe during probe. Bush won't comment on Roe during probe. Translation. Bush working on extending Roe probe to 2009. Off the record, Bush whimpers, he beats me when you're not here. From the New York Times, White House says deficit will fall and keep falling. White House says deficit will fall and keep falling. Translation, to illustrate falling deficit, Bush says, imagine me on my bike. From Associated Press, Hitler drawings to go on sale. Hitler drawings to go on sale. Translation, art critics gush. Talented Hitler was wasting his time murdering millions.
Oh, God.
You know, all this stuff goes on here, Riley. We talk about this issue with the Deputy Chief of Staff, Karl Rove, and his treasonous behavior. We talk about nominees. We talk about this and that. And we talk about the right-wing media and the attack of the right-wing media on the media, the mainstream media, saying that we only, you know, that the mainstream media only reports the bad things from Iraq. And it's my belief that there is no liberal media. There is right-wing media and there is irresponsible media. And it's my belief that if they were to effectively report on this war, if they were to double their reporting on the war, that it would look even worse, that the reality is even worse than what is coming out on the mainstream media now. For instance, we have this story today of it's just heinous. East of Baghdad, a suicide bomber drove an SUV into a group of children, Riley, children, killing 27 children, at least 27 children, and one American soldier. I mean, that's probably not even going to get a lot of coverage.
That's absolute barbarism. And see, and this is something we spoke to very briefly last week, Mark. There was a lot made, and rightly so, about the bombings in London.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact of the matter is, innocent Iraqi civilians are dying in double digits every single day. And since this new government has taken over, the death toll has escalated. But we don't hear that much about it. We hear if maybe the U.S. military gets some insurgents. We hear about that. We'll hear about very general stories about suicide bombers doing this and suicide bombers doing that. But nobody stops the world for the dead in Iraq. Nobody.
And we talked about the other day about this deadline for these indicators that was due from the Department of Defense, from Donald Rumsfeld, about the progress of the conflict, about what's happening, where is the progress. And we talked to somebody about this, and apparently they've extended it, all right? A couple of days ago, day before yesterday, a Pentagon spokesman said those Iraq indicators have indeed been delayed and that there is currently no specific date set for their release. So this was an expectation. This was on paper. Congress demands, and it's on paper. It says, what's going on?
Yeah.
To the Department of Defense, and Rumsfeld says, I forgot, you know what, I didn't do it, I didn't, well, what is it? No, I'm sorry, we're just going to have to put this off until the news is good, until we're ready to pull out of there. What does that mean?
It means that Don Rumsfeld does what millions of American taxpayers do on April 14th, ask for an extension. And what you have here is a situation where you have to start asking yourself, why? Why could he not produce these figures? The fact is, because the figures, although they do contain some good news, contain mostly bad news, and the administration does not want to drop any more bad news with Bush's personal credibility, his credibility on the war, his credibility on virtually every issue across the board eroding by the hour.
Yeah, there were polls out today in an NBC Wall Street Journal poll. The percentage of Americans who believe Bush is honest and straightforward fell to 41% from 50% shortly after the re-election. Mm-hmm. How is that? Right after these people elected him, all of a sudden it's like, I don't like him. Would they just elect him to say that they were disappointed? And those who doubt his veracity climbed to 45% from 36%. So they're seeing through it. It's breaking. The facade is breaking. The non-reality is starting to crack. Karl Rove in his office today trying to somehow manipulate all of his, you know, minions into, you know, holding the reality together. Iraq disintegrating, chaos. Yet even there was a report from that secret Whitehall memo from London that was leaked saying that there is a plan to get the U.S. troops almost cut in half and
down
pulled
to 66,000 from 138,000.
But you know what that means to me? That means that they might do it no matter what, and that, you know, that may be fine, but it doesn't take into consideration that, you know, the war is still going on. This thing is a disaster. I mean, this is a suicide bomber driving an SUV into 27 kids who are talking to American troops or getting candy or whatever, killing one American soldier and at least 27 kids. And they're thinking about, you know, pulling out of there. You know, what that means to me is that they'll just shut the media out altogether. Hey, we're not there anymore, really.
Well, what they're going to do, and there is a political underpinning to all of this. What they're doing is trying to create the pathway, that ramp, to get these troops out in time for next year's midterm elections. And because the elections are coming up next year, I tie a lot of this stuff directly into Karl Rove. I think he is orchestrating this entire strategy. Not the military, not Don Rumsfeld. I think he's looking at because remember, Rove's mission here is to maintain a Republican legacy and a Republican hegemony over the American political landscape for decades to come.
Forever.
How do you do that? The first thing Rove has identified is that the war is unpopular, so you have to do something about it.
Yeah, you get a good front man, George Bush, who's willing to, you know, who's a salesman, essentially. Mm-hmm. He is a salesman, and Karl Rove, his deputy chief of staff, his designer, his architect, if you don't know who he is, this is the guy that's really making decisions that affect your life. Bush is just really an actor. He is a salesman. And as Riley said, Rove is designing the future. That's what he does, is he sits there and he figures out all these angles. And the one thing that he disregards is the needs of people who are working and compromised by the economic policy of this administration. He doesn't care about moral or ethics in the way he conducts his policy. He is shameless about his approach to politics, which is not afraid to compromise national security in the case of outing Valerie Plame, in the face of having his president's policy questioned in Iraq. You know, Joe Wilson was the first kink in the armor of the reasons we went to Iraq. The yellow cake uranium from Niger proving to be false was the first attack on the administration saying, look, you're going there for a lie.
Oh yeah,
and Karl Rove made no qualms about, you know, compromising national security by outing Joe Wilson's wife as a message to other people that would dare question, you know, his policy that he delivers to the American people through his mouthpiece George Bush.
And when you start thinking about who's sitting at that conference table somewhere in Washington, deciding what's going to happen with these U.S. troops, what's going to happen to this coalition presence in Iraq, you can bet no matter what else is going on, Karl Rove is in that discussion.
Do you ever see Karl Rove at a military funeral? Do you ever see the president at a military funeral? Do you ever see the caskets of military soldiers, of soldiers coming home? Do you ever see any of that? Do you ever see the realities of war? Does this administration ever acknowledge that 27 kids were blown up today? Does it ever? No, because it's not important to them. What's important to them is winning at any cost.
Absolutely.
And if that means that kids die, if that means that people are put out of work, if that means that, you know, people won't have Social Security when they need to, if that means that they're going to pass legislation that will disable Americans' ability to get justice in lawsuits against corporations that hurt them, it doesn't matter. That's what they're going to do to maintain power. And they're going to pay lip service to a lot of stuff and mentally masturbate intimidate the public in any way possible and exploit the fear of the public in order to maintain that power shamelessly. There is no transparency in this administration. There is nothing but lies and blame dispersed to others. It's a disaster.
And see, in that context, the idea of postponing a report about how things are going in Iraq becomes trivial to this administration. Oh, yeah, we'll just ask for an extension. No, the American people don't really care what's going on in Iraq. We don't have to really answer to this. This is nothing but a congressionally mandated Iraq policy report.
And to trivialize Iraq is just heinous. And that's why we're going to be hearing highlights from Lawton Smalls in Iraq after
the... Uh-oh.
I don't mean to make the weird shift to comedy, but the weird shift to comedy is our Planet Bush correspondent Lawton Smalls has gone to Iraq with the Truth Tour,
yeah,
the right-wing journalists that are there to ferret out the truth.
I do mean ferret.
Yeah, further propagandize the Iraq war as best they can. But Lawton jumped on board, and we've had a couple of distressing phone calls from him that we'll share with you, coming up next. It's 46 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Is it possible for you to shut the f*** up for 10 seconds?
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Fifty past the hour. It's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Good morning.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. How are you? Everybody okay? Look, we'll be broadcasting live tomorrow, Friday, from Restaurant Florent on Gansevoort Street in the Meatpacking District of New York City. Steve Earle is going to come down and jam a little bit. Freddie Farrar, mayoral candidate for New York City, is going to come down and tell us how he's going to try to win against the mighty Bloomberg. And also comedian Dean Obadala will entertain you if you come down. And if you don't come down, he'll entertain you in your car or in your shower or in your kitchen or wherever you have the radio or on your run, as my mother does. That's Restaurant Florent tomorrow on Gansevoort Street. Gansevoort.
Hudson and Greenwich.
Between Hudson and Greenwich in the Meatpacking District. That's 6 to 9 tomorrow morning. Now, folks, some of you know that our Planet Bush correspondent, Lawton Smalls, has gone to Iraq with the Truth Tour. Melanie Morgan, a second-tier radio personality out of San Francisco.
Would she get a promotion?
Took a bunch of other, B-rate right-wing propagandists on some sort of tour to ferret out the truth in Iraq. And Lawton has gotten on board with them as Air America's representative. We got a couple of distressing phone calls. I mean, yesterday was certainly distressing. We're going to play those for you in just a minute. We're getting emails. I got an email here that says, save Lawton. Don't let him die in Iraq. Bring Lawton home. Who cares if he's obnoxious right-wing ninny? He doesn't know any better. Bring Lawton home. So people are reaching out. Can we hear the two calls, one from day before yesterday and then from yesterday?
Good morning, Lawton. So how are you making out? Is it hot enough for you?
115 degrees. Doesn't bother me a bit. Folks are already calling me Lawton of Arabia. I'm a natural desert dweller, Mark, part Bedouin. The sun does my bidding.
So what, you're in an air-conditioned room, aren't you?
What's your point? I'm a foreign correspondent on assignment for one day, and already you're trying to spin this thing.
All right. Listen up. What have you been doing in Iraq?
As you know, Mark, I'm here on the Truth Tour. Uh-huh. Me and a bunch of us right-wing radio talk show hosts are here to report the truth about America's glorious progress in Iraq.
The Truth Tour. Now, come on, Lawton. Did you know this whole thing was organized by a right-wing public relations firm who works on conservative political campaigns, my friend?
Well, we are out in public. I mean, that's a no-brainer. You get an expert.
No. What I'm saying is this is a totally phony trip, micromanaged by the military and designed to prop up Bush's horrible poll numbers. Come on.
This is
worse than propaganda. This is like a Hollywood junket for Spider-Man or something. I'll bet you haven't even left your room yet, have you?
Well, if you want to split hairs about it, no. But this is a fact-finding mission, Mark. Uh-huh. And let me tell you, the reporting up to now has been a complete disconnect with what I'm seeing with my own eyes here in Iraq.
What was that?
Fireworks, Mark. The Army PR fellas told us the locals are so happy now that President George W. two-term mandate Bush has liberated them, they shoot off fireworks all the time.
Dude, Lawton, those aren't fireworks. Oh, man. Lawton, are you okay, Lawton? Lawton.
Mark?
Yeah?
I've been under the bed for 2 days, but I'm not on the toilet. Fireworks my ass. This place is a hellhole. Nothing works. Explosions all the time. The soldiers all have that worried look on their face. I thought New York was bad. That was nothing. This does not look like we are winning, Mark. Oh,
that was Lawton calling us on Tuesday from Iraq, and then it got worse. Here's yesterday's call.
Lawton, what's the matter with you? You don't sound so good. Where are you? Are you all right?
Well, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Mark, I don't know where I am. Back at the Green Zone in Baghdad, one of my colleagues put me in a Jeep, and I heard him say to the driver, take this guy somewhere where we can't hear him anymore. So he dropped me off out here in the desert and drove off.
Oh, no, man. Would you drive those right-wing radio goons nuts and they kicked you off of the, kicked you out of the compound or what?
No, Mark. They took a vote and said, who's the one man we would want out there gathering information? And every one of them said, Lawton Smalls, send him out there. He deserves it.
Lawton, what did you do? You sang for him, didn't you?
It's funny, Mark. Not everyone wants to hear the score to South Pacific sung to them for 3 straight days.
Yeah, who would have thought?
It's weird.
Yeah. So, how hot is it, Lawton?
Tour.
What?
Stupid. Hot.
Oh.
Mission accomplished.
Oh, no. He's like he's going to hallucinations.
Or axis of evil.
There's something wrong with him.
Good morning, philosopher kings and queens.
That's my line.
Progressive utopias with no sense of humor.
Oh, man.
Deal with it.
There's something really wrong with him.
We gotta, I'm going to wash that man right out of my hand.
Oh, no.
I'm going to wash that
Someone's
man
gotta, I wish
right
it,
out of
I
my
wish
hand.
There's something I could do here.
I'm sorry, Daddy. I didn't mean to break your Nazi bone, China.
Who are you talking to, man? I think he's really in trouble, Riley.
Let me pour you another bourbon, Daddy.
Lawton.
You can hit me if you
Lawton,
want to.
Lawton. 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 I hear a car. Can you flag down that car and get a ride, Lawton? Snap out of it for a minute and flag down that car, couldn't you?
Hi, fellas. I'm Lawton Smalls. I'm here on a truth tour. Can you give me a lift back to my house, please? I'm very thirsty. Can I have a big gulp? Hey, wait a minute. Why are you putting a bag over my head? It's hot out here. Don't.
Lawton. Buddy, you there? Where are you?
Yeah, so that's where we left it yesterday. It's pretty brutal. Hopefully he'll call tomorrow or somehow make some sort of contact. I hope someone contacts with us about what's happening, and then we'll just keep you up to speed as that unfolds with Lawton Smalls. Coming up next, we got Norman Solomon, who's a nationally syndicated columnist, a very decent thinker and columnist, I might add. I get his stuff from Truth Out a lot. He's got a book out, War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. So I think we could really sort of get into some meaty topics with him. Looking forward to talking to him.
Yeah, we got Peter Bergen, terrorism expert, coming in as well in the next hour on Morning's Edition. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Six past the hour, it's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program with Mark and Mark. I'm Mark Maron, that's Mark Riley.
Hey.
Thanks for listening. Hope you're having a good morning. If you're just tuning in, here are some highlights from what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. A newly published letter by the Pope is critical of the Harry Potter books. Pope Benedict disapproves of all kinds of magic unless it involves a 2,000-year-old rabbi's body and blood turning into bread and wine in your mouth.
The Pope said the real reason he was opposed to Harry Potter was he has a book coming out himself about a young altar boy who just wants to spend all day flying from church to church in his magical underwear.
Whoa.
is that wrong? A preliminary agreement between owners and the players' union will bring back NHL hockey. In a related story, experts expect domestic abuse cases to drop sharply this fall. The deal was met by delight from hockey fans, and a spokesman for a fans group said, "Yeah! Let's go, Rangers! Let's go!" Okay. Former WorldCom executive Bernie Ebbers was sentenced to a 25-year prison sentence. 25 years? His 401k should be worth nothing by then. Defense lawyer Reed Weingarten asked for leniency, mentioning Ebbers' heart condition and his charitable work, saying, quote, "He could have stolen more money, but he was charitable enough to stop at $11 billion," end quote. Ebbers was once worth hundreds of millions of dollars. Experts now estimate he's worth about 40 cigarettes. All right.
You know you're going straight to hell. You know
again?
That, right?
Again, do I have to go to hell? How many times do I got to go
there?
I'm
glad I don't have to read those things.
I'm going
to
write a column from hell. Our next guest is a nationally syndicated columnist and the founder and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. He's the author of a new book called War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. Norman Solomon joins us in the studio now. Good morning, Norman. Thank you for coming.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Good morning.
So there's definitely a never-ending spin coming out of this administration. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's not even, they don't even care about people or policy or anything. It's a big game to them.
Never-ending. The RPMs are so fast to make anybody's head not only spin, but just after a while, a lot of people are angry and nauseous at what they're getting. That is the name of the game. The essence of propaganda is repetition, and it's really 24/7, 365 out of the White House.
Absolutely. And when you were, in terms of the war, there's a lot of comments, like, you know, I've been talking about just this morning, where you get the right wing saying the media, the liberal media, always the negative. It's my belief I don't think there is a liberal media. I think there's an irresponsible media and a right wing media. And if the media were to really capture the war as it is really happening, would be more negative.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the myth of the liberal media is just a club to hold over the head of journalists and pundits, by the way, to prevent them from asking tough questions, which, after all, is what journalism's supposed to be. If we had a really assertive, independent media, it would have been very tough for this war to begin in the first place. You know, there's a myth that somehow, who knew there weren't weapons of mass destruction? Everybody thought there were. If you go back and rewind the tape, that is kind of an Orwellian myth that's being promoted by the White House.
Mm-hmm. You know, Norman, when we talk about the war, in particular, and now we look at this ongoing controversy with Karl Rove, it seems to me, at least, that there is a great deal of spin at the center of that. Talk about that, if you will.
Oh, yeah. One of the hidden in plain sight realities of this uproar over Karl Rove is that it's all in the context of war. They are telling lies now out of the briefing room of the White House about earlier lies that they told in order to cover up the initial lies about weapons of mass destruction, yellowcake uranium coming from Niger. All of that was just one fairy tale after another, which, by the way, as I talk about in the book, was promoted avidly. I'm not just talking the Fox far-right folks. I'm talking the front page of the New York Times, the editorial page of the Washington Post. They were behind this war just like, in many ways, as I document, the Vietnam War got boosted by the media.
How did that happen? How did, like, embedded journalists actually boost the media in terms of siding with the war?
Well, in terms of this innovation of propaganda techniques, embedded journalism was touted by the Pentagon and many journalists themselves in their media outlets as being this great breakthrough. You know, there were beefs about the Gulf War. Gee, you don't let us show the bang-bang. We have to go through your censorship. So, okay, come on, make my day. Go in and be embedded, jump into bed with the high brass in the military, and then depend on, for your very safety, bonding with the journalists. And, you know, I would not have a problem with the bonding between the grunts on the front line and the journalists if you also had an equal number of embedded journalists with those at the other end of the bombs, the Iraqi families during the invasions, for instance, who were not having any journalists in their houses being embedded, talking about, you know, it's like, well, once the missiles go out, we don't care.
Well, there's only a couple. Yeah, I mean, we talked to Michael Ware from Time Magazine, who actually spends time with the insurgents. But is there a fear on behalf of journalists of being critical of the war?
Well, even now, I mean, it's a long-term legacy. We've had, for instance, the purge at MSNBC I talk about in the book, the leaked memo showing that the Donahue Show was killed right before the invasion of Iraq, and the management of MSNBC NBC quite bluntly internally, thinking it would never leak, said, hey, you know, our competitors are waving the flag. We can't have any home for anti-war voices as this invasion begins.
Now, you were associated with the Donahue Show at that time.
Well, actually, a colleague of mine was. I eventually looked at analyzing MSNBC in terms of their coverage, along with Fox and CNN. I really would be critical of all of them, frankly.
We're talking to Norman Solomon, author of War Made Easy, and he's the founder and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy and the syndicated columnist. Now, just the other day, also on the news, or what you would call CNN, whatever it is, you have people, you have anchors who are not reporters, they're not news people, and they don't know what the hell they're talking about, yet they almost unconsciously act on behalf of the administration, because I think Kira Phillips is a moron. And I think that, you know, she made this slip. If we could hear it, I want to play it for you. It wasn't a slip. It was just the way she had framed it in her head because of her lack of understanding, I believe. Can we hear that, Chris?
Bob, definitely a major smear campaign going on. I mean, what's the chances of hearing from Karl Rove? Could he speak? Could he come forward? A lot of people said that could just clear the air if he just came forward and gave the facts.
That's her talking to Bob Franken about the Rove situation. Now, to me, she's a moron, and she couldn't even know what a smear campaign is, but it just, you know, plops out of her mouth like a big turd.
Well, a lot of people are saying it's just a catch way of saying that I want to put this out under the guise of journalism. I mean, poor Karl Rove, he has no way of affecting media coverage. That is such an incredible fairy tale, and yet it's being trotted out now after the news media being in a supine position towards Karl Rove for the last half dozen years.
Yeah, well, because Karl Rove controls their access to the corridors of power.
Well, and let's face it, especially after 9/11, this administration that was tanking in the polls until the morning of 9/11 has been utilizing and exploiting this so-called war on terror to get themselves out of every corner that they paint themselves into in terms of lies. And this is not atypical. Okay, these guys are the worst we've ever seen. But you go back the last 40 years, the beginning of the Vietnam War, the invasion of the Dominican Republic, which is one of those forgotten wars I talk about in the book.
65, yeah.
That's it. 3,000 people dying who lived on the island, based totally on lies coming out of the White House. This is not a partisan thing. Lyndon Johnson told lies to begin two wars in Vietnam and then the Dominican invasion during the 60s.
Now, Norman Solomon, we have an issue in this country of people being, you know, not only badly informed, but they don't know anything. I mean, a lot of people don't know who Karl Rove is. And now you get, it seems to me that one of the ways that the administration, this administration deals with it, is you put contradictory, you know, statements out there. You have a lot of different operatives saying different things, and if somebody's taking heat, they go on vacation. I think Dick Cheney might be dead.
Well, you know, for all we know, he certainly is part of policies that are making a lot of other people dead in Iraq and elsewhere. You know, Will Rogers said it's not what they don't know, it's what they know that just ain't so. And the kind of lies that have been propagated and inculcated in folks, I mean, the 9/11 Saddam Hussein myth that there's some kind of link was propagated by the White House, trumpeted by a lot of media journalists, supposed journalists, and the neocons had a field day pounding that drum for years at a time. I'd like to invite people listening. I've got a chapter of my book at warmadeeasy.com on the web. If you go to warmadeeasy.com, you'll see an analysis of the crowd hammers, the George Wills, the way they carry water for this administration and the war makers in general.
Mm-hmm. Norman, quick question. You know, we've been hearing stories out of Iraq in particular. And I've heard these stories and seen this in my own experience covering stories outside the United States, that there is something called hotel journalism, where essentially you have a group of guys who are in a particular place, whether it's Haiti or wherever, and they don't really spend a lot of time covering anything. They just sit in a hotel or they sit at the hotel bar or by the pool, and they just exchange stories. How widespread, in your judgment and your experience, is hotel journalism?
Well, it's very widespread. I mean, I spent a couple of weeks in Baghdad before the war. I was just in Tehran last month. And these folks parachute in. Usually they know little about the country. They don't know, in most cases, the language. They are on deadlines immediately. If they file a story that's different than what's on the wires, the editor back home in New York or Atlanta or whatever is like to say, hey, you know, you seem to be out of sync here. And so in the essence, journalists want to seem a little bit ahead of the curve, but they don't want to go out on a limb. And challenging the administration lies about agenda building for war would be going out on a limb.
Norman Solomon, thank you very much. The book is War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. You can go to www.warmadeeasy.com to read some of it. It was a pleasure talking to you. I love reading your stuff.
Thanks, Mark.
Thanks, Norman.
When we come back, I believe future Mark is going to call. We're also going to be talking about the difference between Islamophobia and racism. How do you like that? It's 16 past the hour, Air America Radio's Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark.
In honor of CNN's 25th anniversary, Morning Sedition is proud to present Great Moments in Journalism on CNN.
He believes, in fact, these prisoners are treated well. He believes a lot of this talk about abuses, that they're actually been overdone, and that this report by Amnesty International suggesting that, in fact, Guantanamo is a gulag is not true. Chairman Hunter also noted that while the Senate, a couple of different Senate committees are thinking about...
Ed, I'm sorry. It's Candy. I'm going to have to cut you off there. We have some breaking news out of California. I am told that we have a verdict in the Michael Jackson case.
This has been Great Moments in Journalism on CNN, brought to you by Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. MorningSedition.com. Our guests, our comedy, your blog. MorningSedition.com. Air America Radio.
Past the hour. It's Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark here on Air America Radio. Good morning, Mark Riley.
Good morning, Mark Maron.
We got Peter Bergen coming up, journalist, CNN terrorist analyst, author of some pretty powerful stuff. I always like talking to him.
Sorry to keep on interrupting you, buddy, but Future Mark is on line one.
Cool, Future Mark. That guy's great. Put him through. Hey, buddy,
what's up?
So, Future Mark, what's going on in 2050?
I'm in Iraq.
Why are you in Iraq?
Well, it's kind of a state now.
You're kidding. Uh-huh. You mean we're still there? We never pulled out?
Well, we couldn't really, you know? We really screwed this place up. The whole region, Iraq, Iran, Syria, they're all states now, buddy.
Wow.
Only they're called Arkansas, Irandiana, and Mississippi.
Weird, man.
Puerto Rico, Cuba, North Korea, they're all states, too.
Wait, like, they were our enemies. The Iraqi insurgency was so strong. I mean, how did it all, like, turn around?
Can you hear that?
Is that Mr. Softy?
Yep, Mr. Softy. Turns out the way to beat the Iraqis was to start feeding them our food. We airlifted in, like, 300 Mr. Softy trucks, introduced cheese to the culture, and boom, Chubbopotamia, my friend.
Wait, you mean they got fat?
And lazy. They stopped praying, they stopped making car bombs. Now all they do is just chase these trucks around. But it's so sad because they can barely run.
Wow, so we just took over.
Well, their fat troops got fatter than our fat troops, and we kind of, you know, won by default. 6 months later, fat Iranians. State. 6 months after that, Syria. State. They started calling it the wide around the Middle East.
Oh, okay, all right. Hey, I thought you said they stopped praying. Isn't that a call to prayer loudspeaker I hear back there?
Nope. That's a call to biscuits and gravy, my friend.
Biscuits and gravy? Oh, man, that's heavy stuff.
Biscuits and gravy brought down North Korea in 2 weeks, dude. Those people were starving. The Pentagon doesn't even bother with military contracts anymore. Now all their deals are with Bob Evans and Jimmy Dean, who are national heroes, by the way.
So wait a minute. Why are you there?
Well, it's a good question. I'm on a humanitarian mission here. I'm handing out Prilosec and blood thinners, and I'm teaching a low-impact aerobics class.
Aerobics?
Yeah.
But isn't the point keeping them fat and docile?
Oh, yeah. So it's low impact. Low impact is the key, buddy. And afterwards, they get to have pancakes. It's just a way of keeping them in shape enough to keep the oil fields up and running.
Wow, we're still after the oil, huh?
Yeah.
Is that what this is all about?
No. These are cooking oil fields, buddy. We found huge deposits here, and we need it for all the fryolators in Iraq alone. You should see the people pack away the fried clams, and they didn't even eat shellfish before.
What's that?
Oh, that's the nacho cheese tanker.
Oh, so they like nachos too, huh?
No, just the cheese, actually. People waddle out with their buckets, and they just fill them up.
Oh, that's gross. Sounds like kind of a sad existence.
Yeah, well, it's no worse than, say, you know, Indiana in your time.
Yeah, I guess. Hey, okay, well, you know, have a good time. You got anything you want to tell me before I hang up?
Yes, I do, actually. The sixth Harry Potter book comes out on Saturday, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Book in chapter 8, all right? About 5 pages in.
Uh-huh.
See if you can build one of those. There's a ton of money in that.
Really?
You'll thank me, man.
Okay, cool. Thanks. Talk to you later.
Later.
Wow. Yeah, it's always inspiring and enlightening. I don't know if we have any listeners in Indiana, but we've alienated a few unless they're sitting there with a bucket of cheese, which is possible. They could be sitting there with a bucket of cheese. In just a couple of minutes, we're going to be talking to Peter Bergen, who wrote the book Holy War Incorporated, which is was one of the most informative books I read about the development of Al-Qaeda. He's a CNN terrorism analyst, and he's obviously a journalist. And, you know, there's stories coming out of London right now that investigators have identified a fifth suspect in the bombings last week. They've identified somebody on a security cam from a train station. He left the station after the other four went on to do the horrendous evil deed that they did. Apparently, there's been up to like 300 incidents of intolerance and hate crimes in London and the surrounding areas. A man was killed. A 48-year-old man from Pakistan who was visiting was killed by a group of kids. I guess not kids. Who knows how old they were?
Youths in Nottingham.
Saying, you know, calling him, "Hey, Taliban." Islamic groups have bonded together after a Nottinghamshire police official described the incident as racially aggravated and said it wasn't. It was Islamophobia. It was motivated by a belief system, which is an interesting distinction to make. Now, Peter Bergen has made comments that were documented in a piece here in The Guardian saying that that British Muslims pose one of the greatest terrorist threats to the United States. So it'll be very interesting to engage him along those lines and see what he means by that and get into what's going on in England, because I'm sure he's up to it.
Well, you know, they just about a half hour ago, Mark, had 2 minutes of silence marking the first week anniversary of the bombings. And now, you know, there's talk, and Peter Bergen can speak to this, about whether or not there should be some kind of a visa system for Britain's coming to the U.S. We'll talk about that and much more next here on Air America Radio.
You're listening to Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hi.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. In a few minutes, we're going to have the next installment of the Morning Sedition Radio Theater's Temple of Doom episodic serial. But right now, joining us to discuss the latest in the London terror attacks is one of the few Western journalists to personally have interviewed Osama bin Laden. He's a CNN terrorism expert and the author of Holy War Incorporated. Peter Bergen joins us from Washington, D.C. Welcome back to the show, Peter. It's been a while.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. I'm reading right in front of me a Foreign Policy magazine report about Homeland Security. And he's addressing the idea that Al-Qaeda remains the largest threat to U.S. homeland security. And he says the organization bin Laden continues to run from Afghanistan or Pakistan is on the ropes. The main threat comes in the form of extremist entrepreneurs with only tenuous links to bin Laden and from other Sunni terrorist groups. The links to Al-Qaeda by these groups are more sympathetic than operational. Two questions. Is that true? And who do you think was behind the London attacks?
Well, I think it's sort of true, except that the notion that somehow bin Laden is out of it, I think, is dangerously wrong. Obviously, he's not in command and control of his organization, but since 9/11, bin Laden's released 18 videotapes or audio tapes, and a lot of these tapes have rather specific instructions, like attack members of the coalition, for instance, in Iraq, for instance, Britain, or attack President Musharraf in Pakistan. And you know, these tapes have, when they get released, I mean, tens of millions of people see them, and I think the people who have these kinds of world view will act on these messages, and certainly we've seen attacks on members of the coalition, whether in Spain or now in London.
Right.
You know, who's behind this? Given the fact that these guys are Pakistani, second generation British citizens, I think they've probably trained in Kashmir, hooked up with the Kashmiri militant groups. Apparently the explosives involved were sort of military grade. That implies to me that they had some training perhaps with a Kashmiri militant group. These groups are somewhat aligned with Al-Qaeda. They share training camps.
So is there any indication that, you know, in talking about the supposed that there may be up to six people on top of the bombers, and certainly they're saying that there was a fifth person involved in this, is there any indication to you, I know you're saying Kashmir now, but is there any indication that some of this may have been organized from people who trained against Americans in Iraq?
I don't think so. I mean, I think we don't have any indications of that. We mm-hmm. have seen, interestingly, you know, a group of French people who went to fight in Iraq, sort of these French teenagers who were out living in a suburb of Paris.
Yeah.
We also saw some Spaniards recently arrested who were planning to go and fight in Iraq. So certainly the notion that Europeans are being recruited to go and fight in Iraq is not outlandish, but I don't think we've seen any examples of British citizens going to fight in Iraq or even planning to right now.
Peter Bergen, you had some pretty strong statements to make about the threat that specifically terror fomented in Britain represents here in the United States. Can you elaborate on that, and what do you think the U.S. government ought to do about it?
Well, it turns out that the British citizens, and I speak as somebody who grew up in London, have engaged in acts of anti-American terrorism in a manner that's pretty surprising. You may remember Danny Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter who was killed in Pakistan.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he was kidnapped and murdered by a guy called Omar Sheikh, who was a graduate of the London School of Economics and a British citizen. Richard Reed, the so-called shoe bomber, was a British citizen. He had a colleague who was another British citizen who also wanted to do a shoe bomb attack on a transatlantic flight. We've seen British citizens engage in suicide attacks in Israel 2 years ago, and now, of course, we've seen British citizens engage in suicide attacks in London. You know, to take all this together, and you've got a pattern where, you know, the kind of conventional wisdom is the sort of graduates of Middle Eastern madrasas who people we have to worry about. But there's very little evidence of that. People we really need to worry about are people who've got the technical and linguistic skills to actually become effective terrorists and who can get into the United States relatively easily. In that category, European citizens obviously fit pretty well, since they benefit from a visa waiver program that makes it relatively simple for them to arrive here. What can the U.S. government do about all this? I mean, this is a tough one. Part of this is, you know, the big picture is a lot of Muslims immigrating into Europe, lack of integration, certain amount of European racism. You know, and this is going to get sort of slightly worse over time, I think, because European populations are declining, Muslim immigration is going up, and there's sort of a toxic mix here where you're getting a lack of integration, a certain amount of alienation, and a certain amount of European racism, and these things keep blowing up, whether it's the attack on Theo van Gogh, the Dutch filmmaker who was assassinated a year ago by a second-generation Muslim immigrant, or whether it's the attacks in Madrid or the attack in London.
Now, in London, we've got reports that there have been, like, you know, perhaps up to several hundred incidents of hate crime, ranging, you know, racially motivated hate crime, and we have the Muslim community saying that there is that these aren't racially provoked. These are Islamophobia. That this is specific to a belief system. Do you find it stunning that, you know, out of the moderate Muslim community, that is the only statement being made? That have you heard anything along the lines of?
I think that the Muslim community is in Britain is going to, as a group, is going to condemn these attacks, and I would imagine a group of Muslim clerics will issue a fatwa condemning these attacks pretty strongly. We saw that actually in Madrid a year after the attacks. A group of Spanish clerics condemned the attacks. So I do think that, you know, I think the Muslim community in Britain is outraged by this. One of the things I'm sort of interested in is that I'm sure that a disproportionate number of Muslims were killed in this attack, because one of the bombs went off in a very largely Arab neighborhood.
Edgware Road?
Yeah. And, you know, one thing, I think we've done a pretty poor job of pointing out that these jihadists, terrorists have done, one of their specialities is killing fellow Muslims. And, you know, whether it was in the 9/11 attacks, where I'm sure a disproportionate number of Muslims died, or the U.S. Embassy attacks in Africa, which happened in countries like Kenya and Tanzania, which have very large Muslim populations, I think, you know, we've got to put these guys on the defensive and point out whenever this happens that they keep killing Muslims, they have no regard for life, including their co-religionists. And we should really exploit this weakness. And we should also point out repeatedly, you don't have to be an expert on the Quran to say, hey, this is against Islam. The Quran is full of injunctions against killing civilians. And when bin Laden's asked, how do you justify killing civilians, he can't justify it from an Islamic perspective because there isn't the language to do it. And I think we should really hammer home on this weakness. How can, you know, just repeatedly say, this is against Islam, the Prophet Muhammad would condemn this, etc. You don't have to be any Islamic expert to know these things.
Mm-hmm. Peter Bergen, you seem to imply in this piece that I'm reading that the U.S. may have to start requiring visas for Britons coming here. Is that realistic? And what will happen when the Britons start requiring visas of Americans?
Oh, well, that's a good point. I'm not suggesting we sort of radically change the program. Obviously, if we've got this visa waiver program with a lot of European countries who are our allies, and we don't want to alienate them. But, you know, kind of given the fact that we're seeing suicide attacks conducted by British citizens, I think you've just got to ask yourself, if they can do it in Israel as they've done in the past, and they can do it in London, they certainly can do it here. And, I'm not an expert in immigration policy, but I just think that we need to look at these programs and say, maybe do you put Department of Homeland Security officials in European embassies around Europe?
That's an interesting idea.
Would have, you know, face-to-face interviews with people that really need a face-to-face interview.
Well, that's an interesting idea. Peter Bergen, your book, Holy War Incorporated, really, you know, blew my mind and gave me, taught me about the evolution of Al-Qaeda. And I have a question in relation to histrionics for you, in the sense that you're really depicting the British Muslim community in terms of the extremist faction within them as being well educated, middle class, and they are, you know, there's 1.6 million Muslims there. And I'm seeing that in Iraq, from all reports that we have, there's a whole new generation of soldiers being developed, jihadi soldiers being developed, fighting against Americans, not unlike the Afghani Arabs fought against the Russians. Do you see this as perhaps evolving the next manifestation structurally of what you called Al-Qaeda?
Well, no doubt about it. And, you know, the difference between the Afghan war and the Iraq war in terms of the sort of jihadists who are being trained is pretty profound, and I think actually works very much against us. The foreign fighters in Iraq are fighting arguably the finest volunteer army in history, whereas the Afghan Arabs, the people who came to fight against the Soviets, were fighting a very demoralized conscript army.
Mm.
Also, the people in Iraq are learning how to make IEDs, improvised explosive devices. They're doing suicide terrorism. All these things have direct applications to urban terrorism. You know, they're meeting like-minded militants from around the Middle East. They're swapping business cards. They're getting very valuable battlefield skills and bragging rights. They are going to, whether you think the war in Iraq is a good, bad, or a different thing, we've got to face the fact that there's going to be a huge blowback problem from this Iraq war. The blowback is going to be pretty intense in places like Saudi Arabia, where it turns out that 61% of the foreign fighters in Iraq are Saudis. That's based on a couple of surveys where they've looked at jihadist websites where people take credit for particular suicide attacks, and they mention people's names and nationalities.
And that's a country that rarely gets reprisals, certainly from the West, because of the relationship there around oil and the relationship with the Saudi royal family. I mean, that's who the hijackers, that's who the 9/11 suicide bombers were, and there's just been no reprisals.
Well, I agree that I think we should really play to the self-interest of the countries that have got the foreign fighters saying, hey, this is, you know, right now you're exporting your jihadist terrorist problem, which, you know, I mean, the Saudis may be thinking, hey, let's give these guys a one-way ticket and hope they never come back.
Mm.
But the fact is that they will come back. And we saw in Egypt in the 80s during the Afghan war against the Soviet Union, there was almost no terrorism. When the Soviets withdrew, suddenly Egypt experienced its worst surge of terrorism, you know, ever.
Wow. Well, Peter, Peter Bergen, it's been always great talking to you. Thanks for getting up and talking to us today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks, Peter.
You take care. That's Peter Bergen, the author of Holy War Incorporated, which to me is the best book on the history of Al-Qaeda. And again, he was one of the few Western journalists to interview Osama bin Laden. And in relation to jihadists, you know, having no qualms in killing their own, we're not sure who was responsible for the suicide bombing in Iraq that blew up an SUV amongst 27 children.
Yes.
Who were talking to American troops. But that type of shameless disregard for any life
is a type of enemy that it's completely, you can't even, is there a solution to that type of lack of conscience? It's 46 past the hour. Coming up, we will have the next installment of Morning's Edition Radio Theater. You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark.
Morning Sedition.
It's just to wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Sedition Radio Theater Company players bring you their production of Mark Maron and the Temple of Doom.
When we last left Mark and Grace, a mysterious priest had brought them to a young girl who was possessed by Satan. Could he point them to the Antichrist? Would he point them to the Antichrist? Am he point them to the Antichrist? What?
I'm not telling you anything, Maron. You and your heterosexual assistant.
You take that back.
Stop it, Grace. You're playing into his game.
I feed on your rage. And on Slim Fast Bars. Your rage doesn't have enough protein.
Enough of your seductive talk, Satan. You know where the Antichrist is and you're going to spill it. Or I'll pull out a secret weapon. Something I've never told anyone about. Something so diabolical that no one can withstand it. It's...
Meanwhile, in a galaxy 20,000 light years from Earth...
On the red carpet...
Jeez, that Tom Cruise is nuts.
And now, back to our story.
And on top of everything else, you'll have to arrive at work at 4 a.m. What do you think of that?
I'll tell you everything. Look, I don't know exactly where the Antichrist is. We're supposed to rendezvous later at the Lake of Fire. But until then, he operates on his own. All I can tell you is that his followers worship him, and he professes to be a man of God. But he's deeply, appallingly evil.
And so, away we went.
God hates fags. Your son died from AIDS because he's a fag and God hates him. He's in hell now. Have a glorious day.
Excuse me. My wife and I are looking for Pastor Fred Phelps.
You found him, brother. Fred Phelps of the Westboro Baptist Church of Topeka, Kansas, and a true Calvinist. Are you too filled with God's love or with semen?
Well, she definitely doesn't contain any semen, and I don't even have that much of my own anymore.
Then you're welcome to hold up this sign and taunt the grieving families of dead fags. Here, the fag's brother is headed this way. Why not chat with him?
I've heard about you people. My brother was a better man than any of
you. Sir, I'm so sorry. I'm not really with these.
Ow! That's it, brother. Let him beat you real good. He'll just go to hell that much sooner.
I'm the one getting sent to the afterlife right now. Grace, help!
Okay.
Hey, help me, not him.
Is Fred Phelps the Antichrist? Can Mark find some polite, politically correct way to defend himself and not get killed at the funeral? And has Tom Cruise really flipped out? Or has he always been a little like that? Find out next week when we hear Katie Holmes say...
Help me!
That's next week on Mark Maron and the Temple of Doom. And stay tuned later for the Morning Sedition Radio Theater Company Players production of Midnight Cowboy. Hear Mark Maron as Ratso.
Well, frankly, you're beginning to smell. And for a stud New York, that's a handicap.
And Mark Riley as the hapless male hustler, Joe Buck.
Well, I am dumb, that's for sure. I don't talk right, I can't think too good. Just only one thing I've been good for is loving.
You're not even trying, Riley.
With Jim Earl as the customer that Mark Riley beats up with a telephone.
You're a lovely person, really. Oh, God. I loathe life. I loathe it.
That's later on Morning Sedition Radio Theater.
Wow.
I forgot I even did that.
I love listening to those. Yeah, because that's what it's sort of like. Did I? Oh, my God. It's all put together and sounds so funny.
Yeah.
Hey, let's talk about this, Riley. Here in New York City, the DC 37, the largest municipal union, has thrown their support to Michael Bloomberg, which some think makes him unbeatable.
Well, you know, New York, for those of you who don't know, is a straight-up union town. And Democratic mayoral candidates have traditionally depended on union support and union outreach. In other words, on election day, getting those different unions to contact their members and make sure they get to the polls. New York has some of the most sophisticated union vote-pulling operations in the United States of America. And what you have seen happen over the last few years is that Republican politicians, from the governor of New York, George Pataki, down to Mayor Michael Bloomberg, make good deals with these large public employee unions, and the public employee unions in return either endorse them or remain neutral against Democrats. This is a blow to each and every Democratic aspirant, and tomorrow, when we're at the restaurant Florent, we'll be able to ask former Bronx Borough President and mayoral candidate Fernando Ferrer, the leading Democrat in the polls, what this means to him.
That's Restaurant Florent at in the beautiful Meatpacking District here in New York on Gansevoort Street. If you want to come down, it's between, what did you say, Hudson
and Greenwich.
Yeah, don't get confused. You can't miss this place. It's right there. It looks sort of like a French bistro, a diner. Yeah. We'll be there from 6 to 9 tomorrow morning. We got Steve Earle coming down to play some music. Dean Obadala is going to come down and do some funny. And we got Fernando Ferrer is going to come and tell us.
Ferrer
is going to tell us. I'm thinking Jose
Ferrer.
He'll
yell at me.
Yeah. I'm thinking Jose Ferrer. That's wrong. He's an actor. Fernando Ferrer.
There you go.
Mayoral candidate is going to tell us how he is going to beat Michael Bloomberg. Also here in New York, there's some discussion about the safety of the subways. Obviously, after last week's attack in London, people started to freak out here a little bit. And I noticed today myself, or yesterday, that the unmanned subway stations, where the gates, where there is no booth and you can only use your card to enter and you only exit through those revolving gates.
Yeah, they're called HEATs. High entrance exit turnstiles.
You can't. You have to single file out of those stations. If something happens late at night, there's no way you can get out. There's no other way. You'd have to go one at a time.
Yeah, and New Yorkers really don't know a heck of a lot about how those different systems operate. There are some intercoms for some, but in the event of an emergency, in the event of panic, it is a prescription for trouble.
We'll talk about Homeland Security a little bit when we come back. It's 57 past the hour. You're listening to Air America Radio's Morning Sedition.
Mommy was a hostess. Daddy was a drunk.
Morning Sedition
on Air America Radio.
Six past the hour. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark. I am Mark Maron. That is Mark Riley.
Good morning.
Good morning to you, Mark Riley. Hope you're having a good day out there. Tomorrow we'll be broadcasting live from Restaurant Florent on Gansevoort Street in the Meatpacking District here in New York City. Steve Earle is going to come down and play a couple songs. Fernando Ferrer, mayoral candidate,
nice,
will be there to talk about how he plans to beat the mighty Mike Bloomberg. And we'll also have Dean Obadala, comedian and half Arab, half Sicilian guy, who's going to do his shtick for us. He's always pretty funny. Chief Justice, Chief Supreme Court Justice Rehnquist is in the hospital today. As most of you know, he's got the cancer and it's getting bad. So it seems that, he may not resign. He may pass away. Also in the news, am I putting that to him?
He may pass away.
Well, he's old and he has cancer. All right, so Bernie Ebbers, the ex-CEO of WorldCom, gets, dig this, man, this is amazing. In a U.S. District Courthouse here in Manhattan, after deciding that his heart condition wasn't bad enough to lessen his sentence, Judge Barbara Jones gives him 25 years, Riley, 25 years in prison for bilking the public and shareholders out of $11 billion. Good. That's what I say. Good.
Well, she did give him a break in that he is supposed to be designated to serve his time at the federal prison in Yazoo City, Mississippi, which is close to his home and close to the place where WorldCom was spawned, apparently.
This was obviously one of the largest corporate frauds in recent memory, and actually the biggest bankruptcy in history. Hurt a lot of people, this guy. Apparently he wept out loud in the courtroom. I think it's high time that we start seeing these guys, these corporate criminals, being prosecuted properly. I mean, hell, in China, they shoot them.
Yeah, in China, they actually do execute people who are convicted of certain types of bank fraud. But, you know, Bernie Evers may have cried, but imagine how many thousands of people cried when they found out that their savings, their investments, and their jobs disappeared as a result of Bernie Ebers' $11 billion fraud.
Yeah, I was experiencing a little joy at his crying. I wasn't weeping. I wasn't losing any tears over that. Let's give Homeland Security Department Secretary Michael Chertoff, the new Homeland Security Department Secretary, let's give him a try. Let's see if he does what he says. You know, he had a review done in March, a couple months after he got in there, and now he presented a proposal to lawmakers and officials and people who work at the Department of Homeland Security. He's got some big ideas to trim the pork out of the agency and restructure a bit.
Well, he's talking about a risk-based approach to funding Homeland Security, which means that the Port of Tulsa doesn't get $500,000 or $700,000.
That's right.
But here's his problem, Mark.
Mm-hmm.
Remember that each and every one of these places, North Dakota and all these other jurisdictions that have been getting Homeland Security money, are represented in Congress. And Congress likes to appropriate Homeland Security money, and they like to try and guide it to their home districts and their home constituents because they figure that's what helps them get reelected. So Michael Chertoff is not going to be able to restructure this on a risk-based approach without some opposition inside the Congress.
Right, but he says he's going to oversee, he's going to do a little more oversight on these contracts to decide whether or not they're necessary. He's going to retool terror watch lists used to screen airline passengers to eliminate the high number of false positives. He says he's going to improve the immigration system by bolstering border security. He's going to put some more personnel and technology at the borders to deter illegal immigrants. And with a newly approved temporary worker program, he's going to help immigrants seeking jobs in the U.S. Into legal channels. He said that along with Condoleezza Rice, he's going to announce plans to ease visa hassles for foreigners entering the country to visit, work, or study. You know, so I think he's got to, and most importantly, announced the creation of an intelligence director.
Yeah.
To centralize the analysis of information gathered by the 11 Homeland Security bureaus. That's not appointed yet. And be interesting, Peter Bergen, who we had on, the writer, terror analyst, said it might behoove Mr. Chertoff to put a representative in some of the foreign embassies.
Yeah, it would probably be a really good idea. And the other thing that Michael Chertoff seems to be doing as a byproduct of this overhaul, Mark,
mm-hmm.
is to begin to use technologies. I don't know about most people most of our listeners who've been through airports lately, but there's a lot more technology there. They have those big things that look like they could X-ray Godzilla, the things that roll through there. You know, the different
things. Oh, yeah, I've seen those things.
Yeah.
They it's sort of this random choice, and they sometimes do the little swatch. They swish that thing on your bag to see if it's got bomb chemicals on it.
Yeah, and take off your shoes and take off your... Well, what I think he's looking to do now is to use more of these kinds of technologies as they become tested and true and work well, and begin to use them in some cases in place of some of the human resource that is now used for Homeland Security.
Okay, let's get into this Karl Rove thing, because it's been brought to my attention that some people might not know just how connected Karl Rove is to the president, George W. Bush. Karl Rove is the deputy chief of staff, but that doesn't mean anything necessarily, because Karl Rove and George Bush are symbiotic. They are metaphorical Siamese twins. They've known each other since they were in
in their early 20s, in their late teens. The history goes back that far. George H.W. Bush hired Karl Rove as an aide after Karl Rove was sort of busted. He was the president of the College Republicans, and he was in, some sort of, competition in an election with another College Republican who dished the fact that Karl Rove was responsible of dirty business then.
Yeah.
And George H.W. Bush, who was the head of the Republican National Committee at the time and a congressman, was brought in to oversee this. This was part of his job. And I think he was so impressed with Karl Rove because Karl Rove impressed Lee Atwater, who was, George H.W. Bush's evil promotional genius, mm-hmm. the guy who came up with the Willie Horton ads, who later died of a tumor in his head because his conscience was rotten. But here, this is Karl Rove, as a young man brought into the fold by George Bush Sr. because of his evil tactics. Now, the story goes, the day that Karl Rove and George W. Bush, our president, fell in love was back in 73. George H.W. Bush said, "Hey, Carl, could you go pick my kid up at the Union Station here in Washington, D.C. and give him the keys to the family car? I got no time for it." So Karl Rove, who hadn't seen George W. Bush in a little while, he's going to pick him up. George W. Bush is coming home from Harvard Business School on a break, and apparently there was an angelic chorus, because this guy walks off the train. He's in his bomber jacket and his cowboy boots, and literally the quote from Karl Rove at the time was, quote, "He was exuding more charisma than any one individual should be allowed to have."
Wow.
It was love. It was man love in its purest form, and from that day on, apparently, people who know the two of them say that their interplay is that of like an old married couple. There's bickering and rivalry, and they joke around. A campaign aide, a woman who was on the 92 gubernatorial campaign of George Bush, said that they're like twin brothers, and they communicate so intimately with each other that much of it is unintelligible to outsiders. Like, but so what we have here is that they are a couple. So when you talk about Rove, you're talking about Bush. They are emotionally intertwined. They're in some sort of unrecovered, codependent dance of death right now, I hope. Bush is Rove's political penis. Rove decides who and what they screw. And that's the way I want to put it. Given that no presidential aide, certainly in modern history, has had as much power as Rove, Riley, as you have told me before. I mean, he designed George W. Bush. George W. Bush's political personality is designed by Rove. So the fact that this guy's taking hits means that this administration is taking hits. If Karl Rove is guilty of treason, this administration is guilty of treason. And now, with Bush separating himself publicly from Rove and saying, look, there's a serious investigation, we'll be more than happy to comment on this matter once the investigation is complete. For George Bush to say that wasn't a bad impression, was it?
I was beginning to say, did you develop a southern accent sometime during the break?
Went into a little Bush impression. But he's distancing himself, and you believe it's at the behest of Rove.
I think it is. I'm cynical enough to think that Karl Rove is orchestrating at least his end of his own defense. And he said to the president, look, you don't have to dirty your hands here. I got my spin machine in place. I got my people in place. I got Ken Melman at the RNC to send out the talking points. Don't worry about me. I'll take care of this myself so you don't have to.
I'll tell you, those talking points don't hold any water with me. You know what I mean? It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how or what language he used to out Valerie Plame, an undercover CIA operative. He did it to take vengeance on Joe Wilson, who was one of the first critics, and brought back proof that the reason that the administration justified the war in Iraq was a lie. And this was meant to teach everyone who thought about criticizing the administration reason to go to war or criticizing this administration for any reason was going to be punished. We're going to hurt your family. That's why Rove did it. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter that he identified Valerie Plame as Wilson's wife, because apparently under Section 421 of the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, the disclosure of any information identifying a covert agent is illegal. This guy is a traitor. He put national security at risk, and because of that, George Bush is definitely in question. Don't let this president distance himself from his man lover. 17 past the hour. This is Air America Radio. You are listening to Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark. In a few minutes, we're going to talk to James Frey about his new book, My Friend Leonard. He was also the author of A Million Little Pieces, about he's
It's a lot of drugs. We've got Sammy the Stem Cell, though, before that, so stay with us for that. We'll talk to you in a sec.
Morning Sedition.
Just to wake up.
Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
I've heard about those people.
On Air America Radio.
Thanks.
Past the hour, it's Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Hey!
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Momentarily, we'll be talking to James Fry, the author of My Friend Leonard, also the author of A Million Little Pieces, about, you know, a lot of experiences with drugs and rehab and, you know, stuff that...
none of us know anything about.
Oh, I know about it. But right now, to help us sort out one of the hottest topics in Congress, the issue of federal funding for stem cell research, we have a very controversial guest, Sammy the Stem Cell. Welcome back, Sammy.
Hi! I'm Sammy the Stem Cell!
Okay, Sammy, let's get this out of the way first. It seems like whenever you're on the show, we get another email complaint from an offended listener. Listen, this time, last time was no exception, my friend.
Well, look, you know, all I said was that I meant more to kids than Jesus did. I'm not saying that I'm better or greater or comparing me with Jesus Christ as a person or God as a thing or whatever that is. I just said what I said, and it was wrong, or it was taken wrong, and now it's all this.
Now, look, actually, I was talking about something else, but...
Well, on second thought, that's all crap. I am bigger than Jesus. No. He got caught. What a chump.
Oh,
no. You walked right into a trap. No one's going to get to touch me. I'm sacred life. Tom DeLay said so. You got that, you dumb heap?
Hey, it's good you brought up the issue of religion, since it plays like a huge part in the debate over who should fund stem cell research. I mean, in your opinion, wait a minute. Did you just call me a dumb Jaime?
No, sorry, Mark. I can't hear you.
Is there something wrong with your headphones, buddy?
No. It's just all that clanging from your 30 pieces of silver. It's throwing them off. You know what I mean?
Why don't you show a little self-respect,
yeah,
Sammy?
Why don't you go choke on a kiwi, you curly-haired sad sack?
All right, Sammy. All right. Last week, we got this email from an angry listener.
Bring it on, chimp.
Dear Mark and Mark.
Bring it on.
All right. Dear Mark and Mark, I like your show, and I will listen on a regular basis. However, when your idiotic bit with Mr. Stem Cell comes on, I turn you off. Sometimes I will get back to you. Sometimes I won't. Put him back in the can. He doesn't belong on your show. Peter. So, Sammy. Sammy, what's your response to that?
Now, funny thing, you should bring that up, Peter, because I did your wife in the back of her can, if you know what I mean. I'm Sammy the Stem Cell.
You're a monster, man.
Yeah, and you're welcome, you plute-headed sauce monkey.
Sammy, don't you care about the good you can do for humanity, that you can cure cancer?
Oh, don't turn me into a cure for cancer, buddy. I want to grow up into a human being so I can become Hitler.
Wait a minute. Oh, my God.
I want to grow up to be Hitler.
No.
I want to grow up to be Hitler. Yeah, it's a paradox, all right, but what the hell? Sieg Heil.
you can't say that, man.
Why not?
You can't say that.
Why not? You liberals are all about expressing your feelings, aren't you? Well, these are mine. I want to grow up to be Hitler.
Stop it, man.
You can't stop me. Tom DeLay says I'm sacred life. Sieg Heil.
Oh, wait a minute.
Come on, Mark. Sing with me.
No.
Now, Vaterland, Siegen,
that's
Siegen.
What is that?
Get
out of here. Get out of here. I hate you.
Morgan comes, the event is mine. Tomorrow belongs to me.
Oh, man.
So, you want me to leave now?
Yeah, that'd be a good idea.
I must never treat me this bad, you... Oh.
Yeah, right back at you, you dumb...
Yeah, well, you know what?
What?
Off!
No, you...
Okay, I'm leaving.
You stupid...
I want to be Hitler.
Get out. Get out. You ought to be ashamed of yourself.
Yeah, Leon was my friend.
Hey, shut up. Yeah, why didn't you cure his cancer then, you bastard?
He wasn't that close to me.
What are you talking?
I'm sacred life.
You're wrong.
Yeah.
There's something wrong with you.
I can be wrong because I'm sacred life.
All right. Take the headphones off and get out, you freak. I've had enough of you.
All right.
You could cure cancer, but no. Hitler, what is wrong with you?
I don't know. Want to do lunch?
Yeah, okay, I'll meet you afterwards.
All right.
Thanks for stopping by. Yeah, take care.
All that from a spot on a Petri dish.
Could you imagine that?
Wow.
And it's amazing that we can see him and he wears headphones and everything. It's a large spot on a Petri dish.
Well, you know, he transformed himself into Robert Goulet there for a minute. I don't know what was going on.
The Nazi Robert Goulet?
Yeah, the Nazi Robert Goulet.
So,
James, I know that Robert Goulet.
Yeah.
The book is that we're going to be talking about is My Friend Leonard, and James Fry, is a guy who's had some serious experience with drugs, dude. And a lot of the book is
about
drugs.
You expect a comment out of me about that?
No, I'm gonna talk to him about it. You know, because I want to talk about the book. But his first book was just a brain-bending, drug-laden adventure.
I hope this isn't too inside baseball for me.
What are you talking about? I know you know people that invented drug culture, my friend.
You mean back in the turn of the last century?
Yeah, yeah. Apparently, this book is about a former crack addict. Who is him? Who is James? And his relationship with a guy he met, who was an aging gangster, and they become close friends. They met in rehab, and I'm looking forward to talking to him about it. I think a little later in the show, what else are we going to get into, Riley? Tomorrow, if people don't know, we're going to be at Restaurant Florent on Gansford Street down the Meatpacking District with Steve Earle. Is going to do some songs, and we got your buddy Fernando Ferrer, mayoral candidate, going to tell us how he plans to beat Mike Bloomberg.
That's
Dino
right.
Dino Badala is going to do some comedy.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, Dean's a good guy.
But next, James Fry is going to be on. So stay here. It's 27 past the hour. You're listening to Morning Sedition with Mark and Mark on Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Thirty-four past the hour. Mark Maron here with Mark Riley.
Yep.
It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. Welcome back. As you know, we will be at the Restaurant Florent tomorrow morning live from 6 to 9. That's on Gansford Street right here in the Meatpacking District of New York City. Steve Earle will be there. We'll have Fernando Ferrer will be there to talk about how he's going to beat Mike Bloomberg. Dino Badal will be there. There will be food there. There will be free coffee. We'll give away some stuff. Mark and I will be there. You can come down and touch us and talk to us.
No, touch you.
All right, that's fine. Any way you want to do it.
Can I touch you guys?
Yeah, sure you can. Our guest, you can sit on my lap during the interview if you want. He chronicled his battle against drug and alcohol addiction in his best-selling memoir, A Million Little Pieces. In his new book, My Friend Leonard, he tells the story of his unusual friendship with a fellow addict. We are pleased to have in the studio today author James Fry. Nice to see you.
Thank you for having me.
You don't look like a crackhead. You seem like you're looking good. You're healthy. I'm glad you got cleaned. It sounded like it got bad.
It got very, very bad.
Yeah. It's got two books worth of bad.
Yeah.
So tell me about the new book. I mean, the first book was all about hitting the wall. And this book seems to be more of an emotional book, more of a book about a relationship that you made with a guy after you got out of jail or in jail, right?
I actually met him in rehab. Mm-hmm. I went to rehab when I was 23. When I went, I was in really bad condition. I woke up on a plane. When I woke up, I had no memory of the preceding 2 weeks.
Oh, that's a big blackout.
Yeah.
Two weeks.
Nice, big, long one. Yeah. And my nose was broken. My eye socket was broken. My front four teeth were knocked out.
Uh-huh.
And there was a hole right below my lip that took 40 stitches to close up.
And they let you on a plane like that?
This was in 1994.
Oh, my God. They're like, could you just put a napkin on that or something?
I was actually carried onto a plane by two doctors and two other people.
Okay, so you had at least temporary. You weren't just all beaten. You had a thing on it.
I had a little thing on it.
What do they call it? A poultice, for some reason, came into my head.
Oh, wow.
Is that what it's called?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It was a thing that held his jaw together.
Yeah, they held the blood in. Okay, so then what happened?
So I went to rehab. My parents sort of picked me up at the airport and dropped me off at this treatment center. And while I was there, I met this guy. He was 55, so he was 32 years older than me. Mm-hmm. And our first meeting, he was mad at me for saying something to him. And I was on some heavy-duty detox drugs. I didn't even remember talking to him.
Uh-huh.
But I stood up and I threatened him.
Yeah.
And he sort of believed that I would follow through with my threat.
Yeah.
It turned out, I found out later that, as he would sort of jokingly say it, he was the West Coast director for a large Italian finance firm.
Wow. Ooh. All right, so we can assume that, he's connected.
Yeah, something like that.
But you scared him nonetheless. That's interesting.
Yeah.
And so we sort of became immediate friends and great, great friends. And, you know, we went through that together. And after I got out of rehab, I went to jail. And when I got out, we remained in close contact. He was, you know, my best friend for up until the point he died.
Well, that's wild. So was he indeed a gangster?
Yeah, absolutely.
Mm.
Now, he was in rehab with you? He was trying to kick?
Yeah, he was a coke addict.
Okay.
He lived in Las Vegas and, you know, sort of lived a high life and needed to deal with it.
Now, did you, was he one of those people that kind of sort of looked out for you during this odyssey towards sobriety?
Absolutely. Like, at the end of our term at rehab, he'd never married and he never had children. And he came and he was like, you know, I want you to be my son. And I sort of laughed at him. And he was serious. He was like, I want you to be my son. I'm going to treat you like my son and introduce you my son and take care of you like you're my son. I found out later he had actually called my parents, who he had met at treatment, to discuss this with them. My parents lived in Japan, so they were sort of happy that I would have some sort of surrogate father type guy.
Did your dad call and say, we've been told that we have no choice but to allow you to be Leonard's son?
The finance company called.
Yeah, sort of strangely, my parents loved him. I mean, he did what he did for a living, but he was a very honest, very ethical, very cool, totally stand-up guy. I mean, I always sort of laugh and say he was more honest and ethical than almost any politician I've ever met or heard of.
Now, what was that honesty? Was there an undercurrent of potential violence below the honesty, below the nice guy?
Yeah. I mean, there was a sense of menace that he carried with him.
I've met people like that.
You know, you could laugh, but you never forgot what he did or who he was. And he often traveled with a guy he called his executive assistant.
Really?
Yeah,
that's weird when you're dealing with people like that, where you realize like this is fun, but after a certain point, I know that you could kill me.
Yeah,
or that you have killed people.
Yeah, I mean, fortunately, I was his son, so I didn't necessarily have to worry about some of that. And
you could just smack you around a little bit,
or I could smack him around a little bit.
Yeah,
but I did work for him for about a year and a half.
Doing what?
Picking things,
collections.
Picking things up and taking them places.
Really? Like things that you didn't know? Like that? Just don't open the bag kind of stuff?
I never asked. I mean,
no, that's good. That's probably better off.
Yeah.
That's why you're not in prison again.
Yeah. the first time I did it, I went to Milwaukee.
Uh-huh.
And I went to a house and I picked up a suitcase and I took it to another house on the south side of Chicago. And after I was finished, I called to say that everything had been fine, and my friend Leonard was like, what'd you think was in the suitcase? What was in there? And I was like, man, I don't know.
Yeah.
He's like, well, how much did you think it weighed? And I was like, I don't know, 50, 60 pounds. He sort of laughed, and he goes, $1 million bills and $20 bills weighs 22 pounds, and the suitcase weighed 4.
Whoa.
So that's what it was?
No,
you're not going to say.
He said what he said, and I didn't ask anything else.
Is there anything in the book that gets you in trouble?
Not now. The book was pretty heavily vetted by the attorneys at the publishing house and attorneys that represented me. And anything that could potentially have gotten me in trouble, the statute of limitations has run out, and everything else is non-prosecutable.
Okay, well, there you go. So your first book, A Million Little Pieces, was bought by Brad Pitt, who I think had a battle with the mild meningitis the other day. But,
did you
hear about that? But that's not besides the point. So is that going to be made into a film? Is he going to play you?
He won't play me. He's like, you know, the character or me in the book is 23 and he's 40 or 42 or something now.
So he knows better?
Yeah, he knows better. he's going to produce it
with
this guy named John Wells, who makes The West Wing and ER.
Okay.
They're going to produce it and have somebody else.
Do you know who's going to play you?
No.
Do you have any input on that?
I do have some input.
Yeah?
I mean,
who do you like to play you? I'm just trying to judge your ego, because you seem like a mild-mannered, pretty humble guy, but I want to hear who you think should play you.
It's such a weird, surreal question.
Like, I can't even handle it.
People ask me that more than anything else. And
all right.
The idea that there's going to be some movie star pretending to be me at the worst time of my life.
That'd be exciting. That would be really exciting.
It's weird, though. Like,
yeah.
I know a lot of these young actors, and a lot of them want to do it.
Yeah.
And it's just still, it is sort of, there's sort of some sort of strange disconnect.
So now I guess publicly, you are sort of out against traditional recovery. And somebody who has been through what you've been through, that's interesting. What is your criticism of Alcoholics Anonymous, and how do you stay sober?
I'm actually not against it at all.
Uh-huh.
I think AA does a lot of good in the world and saves a huge number of lives and a huge number of families. What I was against was having religion forced on me.
Sure.
And, sure. You know, what most people in AA won't necessarily admit it, but AA functions exactly like a religion. It has a specific dogma. It has a specific set of rules. It has a specific hierarchy.
They call them suggestions.
Yeah.
And it's not clear that there is any sort of a big payoff in terms of where the money is going. And it seems to be somewhat vague. And also, they call it a spiritual program.
Right.
Yeah.
Either way, I don't believe in God. I'll never believe in God. And I resented somebody trying to jam the idea of God down my throat.
So it's just a personal kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, I think
because you had that in rehab. Is that where the first experience with it was?
Yeah, I mean, yeah. That's all they teach in rehab. And like I said, I think it's great because it saves lives. But you know, I wasn't going to accept it any more than I was going to accept anything else.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you mentioned that Leonard had passed away. What about some of the other people, either that you met in rehab or some of the other people that you used to get high with? Do you still see any of them? Are most of them dead or alive?
Most of them either dead or in jail. I have, from rehab, of sort of 10 major characters in the book, only one other besides me is still fine at this point. All the rest of them are either dead or in jail for the rest of their lives. You know, a lot of my friends who I was using with younger, I have absolutely no idea. I doubt that they're doing well.
Incredible.
Yeah, there's some pretty heavy, there's some heavy stuff because, like, you know, a lot of the existential sort of ruminations and things you go through when you screw up your life that bad and destroy yourself, I think you capture really well in the book.
Thank you.
And I think that the story, it's a heartwarming story. You also talk about some of those sort of post-rehab romances and some of the stuff that happens when you're walking through the world as emotionally raw and as young as you were, that I think are really nicely handled here in the book. And I hear it's doing well.
It's doing well. We're on every bestseller list in the country. We hit the Times list yesterday. I'm sort of incredibly thrilled and sort of slightly embarrassed and very humbled.
Well, I'm glad you're alive, my friend. The book is My Friend Leonard. James Fry is the author. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's great talking to you. So we'll be back with some closing statements, and maybe let's talk drugs a little bit.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. It's 44 past the hour. You're listening to Morning's Edition with Mark and Mark. This is Air America Radio.
Hello, this is Mick Foley, professional wrestler and best-selling author, and you're listening to the two guys who give the right wing the smackdown. It's Mark Maron and Mark Riley with Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Hey, it's 49 past the hour. It's Land This Thing. I'm Mark Maron. That's Mark Riley. It's Air America Radio's Morning Sedition program. We got the surprise delivery today, a day early.
Yeah.
On the City Bakery goods. Very exciting. Had no idea it was coming. Dan Pashman, son of Lewis and Linda Pashman, who we don't talk about on the air anymore, worked it out for us. Because
hooked us up.
Hooked us up, and we got the surprise croissants and fruit. Very exciting. Kalo, in a masterful bit of social engineering, talks to our new 6'9" intern.
Yeah.
He says, hey, it's okay if I call you Tree, isn't it? Yeah, that's great. Why don't you just call the guy the thing that hurt his feelings all his life?
Oh, and he can kick my ass any moment of any day.
Also, that makes it okay for you to go ahead and hurt his feelings. Maybe he's a soft-hearted giant.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe he doesn't like to kill.
Maybe he'll pick you up and pet you. You know what I mean? What about that, Kalo? Maybe that's just not within him. You know, the guys that size are usually very nice guys. They're not, maybe he's not a mean tree.
It's a nickname.
Yeah. Maybe he's a tree like in
like
that.
Like Halo.
Maybe he's like the first Lord of the Rings movie tree. You
or
know,
an
like
acacia tree.
I don't know. All right, here we go. You know, a lot of people are concerned about Lawton, which I appreciate. We're getting emails. They're worried about Lawton. Lawton Small is our Planet Bush correspondent in Iraq now with the Truth Tour, the group of right-wing radio personalities, second-tier right-wing radio personalities over there trying to get to the truth. Lawton went over as Air America's representative, and we've had a couple calls from him. First one was kind of bad. The second one was real bad. We should get people up to speed so they know what's going on with him. Can we hear that first one there, Chris?
Good morning, Lawton. So how are you making out? Is it hot enough for you?
115 degrees. Doesn't bother me a bit. Folks are already calling me Lawton of Arabia. I'm a natural desert dweller, Mark, part Bedouin. The sun does my bidding.
So what, you're in an air-conditioned room, aren't you?
What's your point? I'm a foreign correspondent on assignment for one day, and already you're trying to spin this thing.
All right. Listen up. What have you been doing in Iraq?
As you know, Mark, I'm here on the Truth Tour. Uh-huh. Me and a bunch of us right-wing radio talk show hosts are here to report the truth about America's glorious progress in Iraq.
The Truth Tour. Now, come on, Lawton. Did you know this whole thing was organized by a right-wing public relations firm who works on conservative political campaigns, my friend?
Well, we are out in public. I mean, that's a no-brainer. You get an expert.
No. What I'm saying is this is a totally phony trip, micromanaged by the military and designed to prop up Bush's horrible poll numbers. Come on. This is worse than propaganda. This is like a Hollywood junket for Spider-Man or something. I'll bet you haven't even left your room yet, have you?
Well, if you want to split hairs about it, no. But this is a fact-finding mission, Mark. Uh-huh. And let me tell you, the reporting up to now has been a complete disconnect with what I'm seeing with my own eyes here in Iraq.
What was that?
Fireworks, Mark. The Army PR fellas told us the locals are so happy now that President George W. Two-Terms Mandate Bush has liberated them, they shoot off fireworks all the time.
Dude, Lawton, those aren't fireworks. Oh, man. Lawton, are you okay, Lawton? Lawton.
Mark?
Yeah?
I've been under the bed for 2 days, but I'm not on the toilet. Fireworks my ass. This place is a hellhole. Nothing works. Explosions all the time. The soldiers all have that worried look on their face. I thought New York was bad. That was nothing. This does not look like we are winning, Mark.
Oh, man.
Yeah, that was Lawton Smalls in a call from Iraq on Tuesday. Clearly in trouble, but yesterday's call is what's really put us over the edge and freaked us out. Can we hear that, Kayla?
Lawton, what's the matter with you? You don't sound so good. Where are you? Are you all right?
Well, Kaham, Kaleem, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Mark, I don't know where I am. Back at the green zone in Baghdad, one of my colleagues put me in a Jeep, and I heard him say to the driver, take this guy somewhere where we can't hear him anymore. So he dropped me off out here in the desert and drove off.
Oh, no, man. Would you drive those right-wing radio goons nuts and they kicked you off of the, kicked you out of the compound or what?
No, Mark. They took a vote and said, who's the one man we would want out there gathering information? And every one of them said, Lawton Smalls, send him out there. He deserves it.
Lawton, what did you do? You sang for him, didn't you?
It's funny, Mark. Not everyone wants to hear the score to South Pacific sung to them for 3 straight days.
Yeah, who would have thought?
It's weird.
Yeah. So how hot is it, Lawton?
Truth Tour.
What?
Stupid. Hot.
Oh.
Mission accomplished.
Oh, no, he's like he's going to hallucinations.
Axis of evil.
There's something wrong with him.
Good morning, philosopher kings and queens.
That's my line.
Progressive utopias with no sense of humor.
Oh, man.
Deal with it.
There's something really wrong with him.
I'm going to wash that man right out of my hand.
Oh, no.
I'm going to wash that man.
Someone's got to. I wish
right
he,
out of
I wish there's something I could do here.
Sorry, Daddy. I didn't mean to break your Nazi bone, China.
Who are you talking to, man? I think he's really in trouble, Riley.
Let me pour you another bourbon, Daddy.
Lawton.
You can hit me if you want.
Lawton. I hear a car. Can you flag down that car and get a ride, Lawton? Snap out of it for a minute and flag down that car, couldn't you?
Hi, fellas. I'm Lawton Smalls. I'm here on a Truth Tour. Can you give me a lift back to my house? Please, I'm very thirsty. Can I have a big cup? Hey, wait a minute. Why are you putting the bag over my head? It's hot out here. Don't.
Lawton. Buddy, you there? Where are you?
That's really scary stuff from yesterday from Lawton. We've gotten word that Lawton is okay. We're hoping to hear from him. Perhaps by tomorrow we'll hear from him. We'll be at Restaurant Florent on Gansford Street, right here in New York City in the Meatpacking District with Steve Rowe, and maybe a message from Lawton. All right, for those of you who are just tuning in, here are some highlights from what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning Sedition Cliff Notes. A newly published letter by the Pope is critical of the Harry Potter books. Privately, the Catholic Church has been spreading a rumor that Potter author J.K. Rowling's, her initials stand for Jesus Killer. The Pope said this could encourage people to believe in magic wands, which is nonsense. And besides, the Pope says the power in his magic, magic meter, what is it called? A mitre. His magic mitre is stronger and will defeat the evil nimbus of gore. Gore! Ran out of breath. Didn't know the word. Bad for how funny. All right. A preliminary agreement between owners and the players' union will bring back NHL hockey. The agreement comes as good news to hockey fans and dentists. After hearing about the agreement, a lot of players who have been idle the last year said they were looking forward to getting back on the ice again as soon as their assault charges are dropped and they get out of jail. Former WorldCom executive Bernie Ebbers was sentenced to 25 years in prison. As he was sentenced, Ebbers dabbed his eyes a couple times. For those of you keeping count, that's around $6 billion a tier. Today's phrase, just drop it into conversation. The Pope is anti-Harry Potter for a reason, man. He's a tool of the Bush administration. Wake up, sheeple. There are clues in all those books about worldwide satanic undergrounds led by members of the Skull and Bone Society that sacrifice his children in their global takeover rituals. It's right there in black and white if you hold the pages to the mirror. Come on, wake up.
Uh-oh.
Tomorrow, Restaurant Florent, Gansford Street, Gansford Street. Meet Packing District.
Freddie Ferrer, Steve Earle, Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition.
On Air America Radio.